Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Years ago this weekend, the city of Los Angeles erupted in rioting following the acquittal in the Rodney King case. To help us remember those 6 days of violent unrest in 1992 and talk about how they influenced the way we think about race in this country to this day, particularly now through the lens of the Trayvon Martin case, our two guests, the writer, activist, and South Central native Gary Phillips joins us from L.A. He's the author of several books, including Violent Spring, a mystery novel set in the aftermath of the riots. Also joining us is Tricia Rose, the professor of Africana Studies at Brown University and author of The Hip-Hop Wars, What We Talk About When We Talk About Hip-Hop and Why It Matters. Welcome, Gary Phillips. Hello from New York, and welcome back, Tricia Rose.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to be here.
Gary, let me start with you. You've always lived in L.A., I understand. You're from South Central. You've said that during those 6 days, you stayed like, quote, any petty bourgeois homeowner guarding the homestead with a handgun and Jack Daniels for courage. What are the things
What could go wrong?
Yeah, I guess a lot. What are things that stick out most in your mind as you look back?
Well, in reality, to flesh that out a little better, I was working at a community organization. My background includes being a union organizer and a community activist, and I was working for a nonprofit that funded community organizing. And so, for me, it was a kind of interesting, a dual condition
experience.
Or a dual existence, which is to say. Both, I understood, of course, the frustrations that exploded post those verdicts and why people were out in the streets, but also then thinking about then what's going to come after that, what's the rebuilding, what's in fact has to be done in terms of on the ground work to not only just better race relations, but also in fact to better material conditions for people in those affected communities.
Tricia, you're a New Yorker, and you were here, I gather, while this was all going on in L.A. What were you thinking at the time? And do you remember anyone being surprised that the reaction to the verdict there was so explosive?
No, no one in New York that I was speaking with were surprised. I mean, there were people who were mostly just terribly worried and upset and understood, but especially, you know, people of an older generation knew that this might not lead to what people thought it might, which is, oh, well, now they'll listen. You know, that's the underground logic, but it's really never been true. So there was just a lot of sadness and a lot of concern. But, you know, in terms of my own response, you know, my first lens through it was as a person who studies urban history and black urban history in particular. So it was quite understandable when you really know the details. And the second lens was through hip-hop, which was another area of research. And it was quite clear that West Coast rap was making it abundantly clear there were lots and lots of issues that riot and insurrection / uprising, depending on who you talk to, you know, really signified and illuminated. So it was not news to me historically or in terms of hip-hop.
In fact, since you mentioned it, we brought a clip of the Ice Cube song Black Korea off the album Death Certificate by Ice Cube from 1991. So this was the year before the riots, and it seemed in a way to anticipate that something like this could happen. Listen.
Mm-hmm. Yo, check it out. So don't follow me up and down your market, or your little chop suey ass will be a target of the nationwide boycott. Juice with the people, that's what the boy got. So pay respect to the black fist, or we'll burn your store right down to a crisp. And then we'll see ya, cause you can't turn to get em in the black career.
And Tricia, of course, that was heard as extremely threatening at the time and racist against Koreans. But it also reflected something of an emotion that was to some degree in the community.
Well, it wasn't just an emotion, you know, this is why we have to have historical backdrop, Brian, which you're always so careful to do, because, you know, the history of new or other ethnic groups being able to own small businesses and profit and care for their families by setting up shop in black communities where African-American small business people cannot get loans, cannot get enough capital, are not given opportunities to actually work in the only neighborhoods they're allowed to live in is a source of enormous outrage and frustration. And it's true. It was the case in Harlem in the 20s. It was the case in L.A. In you know, the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So this is what Ice Cube's really talking about, this ethnic racial gap, which produces a certain level of suspicion and hostility on both sides. And ultimately, though, the community that lives there should be able to have the resources to have small businesses in their own neighborhoods, right? The reverse doesn't true. There aren't thousands of black businesses in Korean neighborhoods. I mean, that's not an anti-Korean statement, right? It's just a fact that shouldn't be acceptable. And that's what I think gets pulled back, and we don't pay enough attention to that.
And we're not hearing songs like that today. Listeners, call us up if you want to share what sticks out for you about the L.A. riots. What do you think you learned? Maybe other people listening who were in L.A. at the time want to call in. And what do you think the country has learned? 212-433-WNYC. In light of the Trayvon Martin case coming up just at this 20th anniversary, what do you think the parallels are or aren't, especially in a big picture context? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. For Tricia Rose, Africana Studies professor at Brown, author of The Hip Hop Wars, What We Talk About When We Talk About Hip Hop and Why It Matters, and Gary Phillips, author of several books, longtime L.A. resident, mystery writer. He wrote Violent Spring, a mystery novel set in the aftermath of the riots, among other books. Gary, you know, a discussion has broken out on our comments page already in advance of the show about what we're supposed to call these events from the past. Right. Was it a riot? Was it an uprising? Was it civil unrest? Do you have an opinion about the terminology and whether it matters?
Well, I suppose it matters in the context of how you place these things, both not only in the historical context, but also in the political context. I'm old enough that I was a kid when Watts jumped off in 65, and I vividly remember the reaction of my dad, who was part of that black migration that came west here from the South. Well, he came from Texas, so the Southwest. But all that is to say, While he was not out there in the streets throwing Molotov cocktails, he also had a smile on his face, because it was about time that folks rose up and sort of signaled that was not going to be the same as it always was, in the sense of police abuse, inequality, etc. And so, of course, then you could transport that to 92, and a lot of those same conditions came forward again. Of course, the big difference was in Watts in 65, you actually had a government response. You actually had the Johnson administration, the Great Society. You actually had some effort from the federal government to at least provide some amelioration to the conditions. Whereas then in 92, we had Bush the first on his bus tour come through after the conflagration and essentially say, you know, the federal government can't help you, can't do anything for you, and therefore it got punted to what became then Rebuild LA, this sort of public-private partnership that, in a lot of ways, it had a lot of lofty goals, but frankly fell short in many ways.
You know, it's funny that as we look back today, we're having this conversation as a lot of New Yorkers are going outside to take pictures of the space shuttle flyover as it's going from D.C. to JFK to be housed at the Intrepid, something obviously trivial relative to this. But you tell this story from the riots about how you went out during the day to take photographs of the wreckage of your city. And you came across a Japanese-American photographer who was doing the same thing. He asked to hang with you so that nobody would mistake him for a Korean,
right?
Reference the Ice Cube song that we just played. And obviously that became a huge part of the story, the conflict between the Korean and the black communities. What is that like now in L.A.? You know, as Tricia just said, we still don't see a lot of small black-owned businesses and other people's neighborhoods around New York, or probably around the country. But how did that dynamic resolve from an L.A. perspective?
Well, you know, it's fair to say, Brian, that certainly you can look at in L.A. now, Koreatown, if anything, is much larger. I mean, the physical presence of what is called Koreatown is much larger. Not, and it's not to say that, by the way, that there's a great we are all the world kind of conditions that exist between blacks and Koreans. But to some extent, and I want to make this clear, you know, before the uprising, there was the Black Korean Roundtable, which was actually trying to work at some of these issues. And this, you know, because remember now, Ice Cube's song comes in the wake of the Latasha Harlins incident, where a young black teenager is shot in the back of the head. After a verbal altercation with Soonja Do, and Soonja Do then,
right, there were incidents in Korean groceries in New York too before the Ice Cube song that didn't result in death, but they were intense.
All that to say is that one of the results coming out of 92 was in fact Korean merchants understanding that it behooved them to hire locally and understanding there was economic conditions why you worked your family because you could work your family, you didn't have to pay them as much, et cetera. But there was another overall different kinds of conditions that said that, well, it's important that we do hire folks who were in the neighborhood, not only as a symbolic kind of gesture, but as a way to sort of open up those kinds of lines of communication. But if anything, now, I mean, you know, if you look at you look at where I grew up in South Central, which was predominantly black then, I mean, it's predominantly Latino now. So there's all kinds of other interesting, you know, dynamics that are at play, and that then, I think, challenge community organizers, people who are about social change, about doing power analysis, et cetera, to make these communities come together in a kind of economic basis and understand that we're in the same boat in a lot of ways, and moving beyond, or at least understanding that there's race and cultural factors, no doubt about it. But we also have to figure out how do we then come together around other common issues.
We have a full board of callers. Let's get some folks' voices on here. Crete in Riverdale, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling. Oh, it's Orit. Okay. I'm sorry. I saw that O as a C. Orit, is that right?
Yes. No, I just want to say that I was actually a teenager. That was my senior year of high school, and I was living in Beverly Hills. I was going to Beverly Hills High School, and it was a very scary time. I just remember the principals and vice principals of our school going door to door in our classroom, going, "Everybody, go home. Call your parents. Get in your cars. Go home. The city's exploding. There's a riot going on." I mean, saying it calmer than I'm saying it now, but. And it took 2 hours to go a mile to my house. And we spent 3 days. There was no school. Everybody was scared. And people came to our high school, actually wrote graffiti all over our high school. And it was an extremely scary time. We were hunkered down in our house watching TV. Nobody could leave. We couldn't go to our friend's house. There was curfews all over the city. It was a very frightening time to be a kid in L.A. at the time. And we could see the city burning from our windows in our houses. I mean, it wasn't like we weren't isolated. So it wasn't just in those communities. All of L.A. was under lockdown. It was very scary.
Orit, what do you think the country has learned, if anything, in the 20 years or from that time?
Well, I'm actually, the funny thing is I'm a history teacher. I'm a high school history teacher.
Huh.
So for a unique perspective, I think that we have come a long way. There are still problems of narrowness where people stay in their own communities and they don't spend enough time learning about other people, so people become other, and that's the problem. But I think that we have come a long way in that we see ourselves more of a community rather than us against them. But, I mean, I work in a Jewish high school where it's very narrow. I mean, a lot of these kids do not venture out of their communities. So, I mean, and it's the same way I used to work in a Catholic high school where a lot of those kids didn't venture out of their communities.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's I think we just need to reach out and learn about each other, and that kind of takes away some of the angst and fear that we have.
Orit, thank you so much for
Brian.
Your call. Trisha, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to, as a teacher as well, I just want to point out that there's no question that, you know, people often stay in their comfort zones as individuals and as communities, but our job as educators, certainly mine, is to undo the erasure of what's really going on structurally. That is to say that we come to each other
as individuals, as teenagers, and then in colleges, if we're lucky, with a real misconception about why we have racially segregated neighborhoods. It's not affinity. And what I find is that young people, once I unpack the history of redlining and housing discrimination and police brutality and job discrimination and the maintenance of these fixed boundaries and how profound they are in shaping not just the destiny of the people today but the people tomorrow, they're angry that they've been lied to. So I think in addition to getting out of our personal comfort zones, we have to challenge education to be much more forthcoming about how the society is structured.
Tricia Rose, Africana Studies professor at Brown University, Gary Phillips, also with us, author of books, including the novel Violent Spring, a mystery set in the aftermath of the L.A. riots 20 years ago this weekend. Rodney King himself has a new book out, as I'm sure you both know, and he was on WNYC this week on the Leonard Lopez Show, and here is maybe the most provocative thing he said in response to a question about the Trayvon Martin case.
It's just another thing where, you know, where it's easy to kill a black man, a black kid also these days, and get away with it because it's been going on so long.
So, wow, Tricia Rose, if that's the dominant perception, that it's easy to kill a black man in this country and get away with it, and a lot of people will have a strong negative reaction to that statement, but that's an echo of the feeling 20 years ago in L.A., same thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure Gary can speak to this. I mean, not only is he, by the way, an extraordinary novelist. I read his work all the time. But that sense of not a you're entirely welcome. My friends will be very excited. I was on a radio show with you. I'm very concerned that, you know, the subjectivity, the lived experience of black people has really disappeared from people's perceptual equation. They live in a world that is not the world that black bodies live in, you know, especially poor male adolescent black bodies. I mean, the hundreds of kids who outpour stories like identical to Trayvon Martin except the ending, or identical to Troy Davis, or identical to fill in the blank, is just ongoing. And it doesn't square with people's fantasies about where we are. And so they sort of take it as sort of bizarre and exceptional. And until we confront that, you know, this is this is the gap we're going to keep creating.
Right.
And
exactly, that you can get this kind of, just bizarreness. Like, you know, you hear Geraldo Rivera going on, you know, about how, well, the kid shouldn't have been wearing a hoodie. Or, there's actually a similar incident that happened out here. Kendrick McDade, a young man who was shot by the Pasadena police officers because somebody claimed that he was armed, who had been robbed, and so he says this to get the cops out there quicker. And when they come out there, and one thing leads to another, and Kendrick McDade is unarmed and is shot by the police. And now this is an ongoing case, and so exactly that. I mean, I'm a father of a young black man. I mean, my son is grown now; he's 25. But when he was a teenager coming up, I mean, he's tall. He plays basketball, so he's out late at night sometimes, and he's got tats, and he could be, kind of gives that image, but he's a really sweet kid. But it doesn't matter because, as Tricia said, I mean, there's a whole persona, there's a whole perception that exists, and as long as that's projected on young black men, I mean, it's deadly.
Adam in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Adam.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Good morning, panel. This is a great subject. But what I wanted to speak to also and kind of connect the dots is to, you know, the broader issue about when you have these kind of social upheavals that happen, and when they happen in the predominant, you know, so quote-unquote ghetto areas or lower-class areas, and it's just like, you know, it's a result of people being frustrated about opportunities, frustrated about mistreatment, frustrated about our children being murdered, and no justice. But what I'd like to say is that what America should do is focus a lot on the social and economic inequities, because it's only a matter of time before these things start really going into other neighborhoods where people may start to, you know, fear a little bit more. You know, when you have more haves than have-nots, and with the way the country's going now, it's only a matter of time before these issues blow up even worse. So I think it's good that we're having these discussions now, but I think that not much really has changed when you look at things in the larger context of our country.
Adam, thank you. And I don't know if either of you, as we start to run out of time here, think that we are sitting on that kind of tinderbox or not. I think about all the cases that have happened, or at least, you know, some of the ones that I've covered, since the L.A. riots. There has been such a determination on the part of the communities involved for there not to be violence, whether it was Amadou Diallo in New York, Sean Bell in New York, and with all the protests that have gone on around Trayvon Martin right now, peaceful, 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 peaceful. And I tend to think, Tricia, that some of that is with the L.A. riots in mind. But, you know, tell me what you think. And I would guess if George Zimmerman is acquitted, there isn't going to be anything like this in South Florida or anywhere else.
Well, I wouldn't be so sure about that. It depends on what happens during the trial, what evidence is presented. I mean, remember, it wasn't just that Rodney King got beaten badly by the police. He's by no means, unfortunately, the first, you know, one of the first 20,000 black men to be beaten mercilessly by the police.
It was the acquittal of the officers.
It was on video, and the evidence was right there.
Yeah.
And yet, the system reproduced the fundamental denial of injustice and just mistreatment in the most egregious way. So the question is going to be, with this case, what happens? What's revealed? What's proven? What's visible? And how it gets responded to? People are trying to be peaceful, and I think it is ultimately much more important to create structural change and burning up your own neighborhoods or getting into horrible violent exchanges with innocent passerby is not going to answer that. But if the rest of society continues to turn a blind eye on the enormous suffering that not just African Americans but many poor people continue to face, and the racialized history and contemporary role of it, right, the way race plays a role, if we don't as a whole society take that on seriously and consistently, we won't be able to keep the peace for long.
30 seconds, Gary, a last word.
Well, I mean, I think Tricia said it precisely. And in fact, I mean, the one thing that's of interest to me is that where does, for instance, the Occupy movement go now in the sense of tackling some of these issues? They've, you know, been looking at issues around foreclosures. And again, for me, it's like figuring out what are the economic issues, what are the social, structural issues that, in fact, bring us together that we share in common.
And, of course, where there has been violence recently, it's been in London, it's been in Greece, it's been in Paris, and people say it could happen here, not necessarily with respect to an isolated or a particular incident, not so isolated, but particular like Trayvon Martin, but to the whole larger sense of inequity and the underlying economics of it, which,
right,
you know, are present
That's
in this country, too. So hopefully
Absolutely. It
won't come to that. But this is our remembrance of the L.A. riots 20 years ago and our connection with today. And we thank Tricia Rose, Africana Studies professor at Brown, Gary Phillips, South Central native, author many times over, including Violent Spring, a mystery novel set in the aftermath of the riots. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
And listeners, you can keep the conversation going on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Coming up next, Mary Phillips Sandy from the Comedy Central politics blog Indecision Forever. We'll get her take on the student loan standoff and more.